arahato samma sambuddhassa buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. That is just the traditional beginning of a Dhamma talk that all the Dhamma talks are always the burden of authority and responsibility shifted onto the Buddha. And I, you know, sort of dedicate this Dhamma talk to the Buddha, depersonalizes the thing. What I have to say, or most of what I have to say, is just things that I owe to the Buddha. I didn't think of these things myself. I wish I had. But all it really Dhamma talks are, and Dhamma speakers are just their real function is to retranslate the Dhamma into the language of the contemporary culture and the people, and trying to be concerned with communication, who you're speaking to. So that is the kind of what one has to do first, though, of course, is instead of just reading the suttas. But I find that when people have just are scholar sutta scholars, the suttas are the discourses of the Buddha, often that when they give them out, it sounds very textual. And so what the Buddha really wanted was that one, you know, interpreted in the light of one's own experience. And then it's more suitable. Many of the discourses the Buddha gave were, well, in fact, all of them were to very specific audiences, and usually in the sutta it's mentioned that who he was talking to. Sometimes a little thumbnail sketch of the listener will be presented. So maybe it's a group of, sometimes it's a group of enlightened monks. Sometimes it's a group of unenlightened monks. Sometimes it's a group of monks that have are badly behaved. Sometimes it's a group of lay people, and among them are enlightened people, enlightened lay people. That the discourse, purpose of the discourse, is to take them from one stage of enlightenment to another stage. It gets very tricky near the upper ends of the path. Sometimes one has got almost everything there. It's just almost perfect. And then, but it's just one small thing missing. It's like one of those great cake recipes, you know. You can't quite get your aunt's. There's something missing out of that recipe. It's just the little essence of walnuts or something. Those are very subtle discourses. And then there are introductory discourses. The Kalama Sutta is an example. A beautiful talk the Buddha gave to people who weren't Buddhist and had no faith in the Buddha. They regarded him as a wandering monk, one among many, who taught, had a teaching, and teachings are just referred to as dhammas, so everybody had a dhamma, different teaching. So in his address to the Kalamas, he offered them the best sort of advice to people who had openly told him, well, we have no particular confidence in you. In fact, we have no confidence in any teacher, but we're looking around. So what can you suggest for people who are looking around? So that the Kalama Sutta is a very beautiful address by the Buddha regarding that. And it's very interesting. Like, he just drops all a sense of, he doesn't speak from a point of view of authority. He never says, you know, whatever I say is true and not otherwise, and I know, and this and that. So he's approaching it from a point of view of how he would, he's saying, this is how I would go about it if I wasn't sure how to go on with it. And he's advising people then to rely on their own common sense, ask themselves a few basic questions. Sometimes it's helpful that these questions are formulated. Some of the forks in the road are sort of articulated, and looking at the choices that one has to make, and which one would be, since these forks in the road are, obviously if you're before the fork, you don't know what's at the end of these two roads, but you have to make some decisions. Situation we're confronted with often in life is that we continually are asked to make decisions when we really don't have adequate knowledge about the consequences of our decisions, and yet we're forced to decide anyway. And that is, in a sense, the essence of life. Or until one is deeply enlightened, or a Buddha, or something like this, it's going to always be that way. That you're in this kind of game. And you don't know. One thing, all you know is that you're not allowed to quit. You've got to play. Life is the game that must be played. It's one you can't get out of. Anybody get out of it? How do you get out of it? There's no way. So there is a lot of decisions to make, and they're not all clear. So. This element of having to be your own teacher, one of the things that the Buddha would say again and again to people is, you know, it's good to, it is proper to doubt that which should be doubted. That's always good to stick that on the end. Quite often, our society is somewhat different than others, and it has a very large emphasis on doubt, inquiry, and maybe leaning towards skepticism. Society at the time of the Buddha, there were certainly all of the modern views that we have on nature, that perhaps it's all just a material process, and when you die, it's all over, that there are no consequences to whatever you do. They were all completely explored and well known at the time of the Buddha and before. These views have always been about, and so they're nothing new. It's just in our society, there's just, because of science, technology, materialism, etc., there's a larger sort of proportion of the population that's at least playing around with those views. So the Buddha talks about doubt, and that, of course, you have to doubt. I mean, obviously, if you believed everything you heard, that would be unwise. And on the other hand, if you doubted everything you heard, that would be unwise. I think it's one of the great French scientists, physicist, I think it was, or a mathematician, who said, you know, these are two equally convenient attitudes, to doubt everything and to believe everything, because they eliminate the need for thinking. And unfortunately, you can't do either. You can't doubt everything and you can't believe everything. You are, the work is thrust upon you to make decisions and not to just push it aside. So in our practice, we also, perhaps one has a general sense of confidence in the Buddha, or that there is something to the meditative path, the Eightfold Path. One doesn't have to think too much about the higher consequences of it, but it's a way to a greater sense of ease and peace and stability in this life. And the Buddha is encouraging one to trust a little bit in one's own sense of judgment, and to teach oneself, not to just take up a practice and then just keep doing it without any reflection and checking up on yourself from time to time. And people do this, as they do in all aspects of their lives. They just get a little... people go golfing and maybe they never got a golf lesson in their life, but they grab the club however they figure it should be held, and they whack the ball, and that's, they do that for the rest of their life, same way. It's without, it sort of works. They've got a sense of how to do it, and if they changed the way they held the golf club or something, it would be strange, uncomfortable, the unknown. And however miserable their golf game is, at least they know how to do it. And then there's other people who, they don't take that attitude. Probably other people have thought about this. And there's probably some good tips I could get off other people who have experience. Maybe I should listen and try. And then when they do listen and try, and they get some results out of it, but they keep reflecting and ask, now, is this the result? Is this as far as I can go with this? They keep inquiring from time to time. Of course, there's also, there's extremes of that, where you're just constantly trying to find the very best way, the ultimate supreme, and you're just endlessly asking questions, almost not thinking, not listening to them, just asking them. Another sort of extreme. This is the same with your practice. People show up, imagine Samedo and Ajahn Chah have many stories about people who are just endlessly just going from teacher to teacher to teacher to one thing after another, just hoping for the perfect kind of teaching, the perfect situation. And this in itself forms an impediment to their actually getting on with some reasonable practice. And other people are just, they heard one thing and then they just did that and they never went and on and reflected on it and thought, wonder if I can expand this or etc. So those are the two extremes we want to watch in our own practice. And the practice is, I'm including in the practice your general life, how you deal with people, how you deal with your families, how you deal with getting through the day, how you deal with going to sleep, etc. This is all part of your practice. And to some degree, I encourage you to make some common sense reflections for yourself. The path or the basic structure of meditation is not all that mystical or mysterious. It is not so complex that no ordinary person can even deal with it. It is something like, it's like physics to some degree. There is this esoteric, mind-blowing notions. But in this, at the same time, we got to go out and play tennis, and we have a sense of, if we hit the ball too hard, it'll go over the fence, and if we hit it too soft, it goes into the net, and somewhere in between. So we do have to deal with these things at the common sense level, and the same with our practice. We don't have to read all 6,000 pages of the Abhidhamma before we get a glimpse of how things should be. So we can, most of what I've read in the suttas and in my practice and listening to teachers have been fairly commonsensical. Of course, often it's only afterwards that we realize that. It's a little bit like the obvious question, why is life interesting? It's because you're interested. It's very obvious afterwards, but not so obvious before. So when we examine our own practice, we should do a few things. It's a little bit of a balancing act. The Buddha's into balance, centering, moderation. It is a path which avoids extremes. And so one should be asking oneself, what am I experiencing when I sit down to do my breath meditation? Do I enter kind of a ghost realm where there's gray nothingness forever and nothing happens? Or is it just this monkey mind just jumping all over the place? Those are two extremes. One of them is moving towards drowsiness, and so on. The other one is moving towards agitation. So one should say, is it beneficial to sit here and just be agitated? Is it beneficial to sit here in a kind of a gray fog floating in the Sargasso Sea? Neither is really beneficial. But just by doing it does not improve. Long before I was a monk, I was a musician. And we had a saying, practice does not make perfect. Only perfect practice makes perfect. It's the same with meditation. Practice doesn't make you perfect. It is right practice. You've heard the Eightfold Path. It's not just the Eightfold Path, it's the Noble Eightfold Path. These four truths are four noble truths. Each factor of the path is Samma before it. So this word Samma, S-A-M-M-A, could be translated very nicely as perfect. So when he says to walk or practice the Eightfold Path, it's not any version of speech is all right. It's only right speech or perfect speech that it moves you towards the end. What is the end? The end is perfection. But what is perfection? What kind of perfection? Perfect peace. So we're moving, the Eightfold Path is the perfect path to perfect peace. There's a saying in the West, I can't remember who it was, it's a Western religious teacher, who said, and this is part of his ordinary experience as well, there is no way to peace. Peace is the way. And the Buddha is also saying this too. You don't advance along the path by going off in another direction. It's only when you hit the path that you move along the path. So when your meditation is going well, it will have results. Or when you are putting in the right ingredients, results will appear. So when you come to a sitting, what you're about to experience is probably not what you're really doing is not meditating at that point. What you're going to do is sit down and experience how you've been doing for the last couple of days, maybe the last week or even the last month. You're going to be experiencing the results of what you put into the cake. So it's not when you set the cake in to bake, what are you experiencing? That's not when you make the cake. It's all the prior stuff that makes the cake. And then all you got to do is turn on the oven. At that point, it's all done. So when you think about your meditation practice, don't think of it sitting as the sitting. Think of it as everything but the sitting. The sitting is the dessert, is the reward of it. If you utilize the Eightfold Path, if you rightly approach the sitting, then the sitting will be there. Results will be there. If you put in the causes, the effects must follow. If you haven't put in the causes, the effects can't follow. So it's getting our kind of, and this is, we're normally like this, especially perhaps in our social values, we're very goal-oriented. We just want the goal, we want the thing. We don't want the process to it. We want to discard the approach to it. We just want the thing. But the Buddha is saying, you can't help but get the thing if the right approach is put in. So never mind the thing. Take your mind off the thing. Get away from the thing. Let go of the thing. Forget about the thing. Everything is the path to it. So Ajahn Chah expressed this too, and this is a kind of thing. It comes upon you as you practice more and more and more. When you do get results, it's handed to you. Other traditions, like Christian tradition and some of the Pure Land traditions, everything, is a notion of grace. We don't really speak about a notion of grace. it is almost, we can understand why people talk about grace, because it seems like something was just given to you or handed to you. But you, what you've forgotten is all the practice that went into it. That, you know, it didn't happen like that. It didn't come out of the blue. It didn't happen for no reason. It happened because of reasons, causes. So, in a sense, our version of grace is the results of effort. So, you see Olympic tower diving or something like this. You see these gold medal. It's just so effortless, isn't it? And that is true mastery. The when they're diving in the Olympics, they're in fact is effortless. If they haven't done all the work by then, it ain't going to get done in the Olympics. not on the last dive. You're not practicing anymore. Practice is over. You either have put in the preconditions for that, or you haven't. And if you haven't, you can't do it then. Referring back to when I was a musician, I had to, it was in the classical music field, so you had to play these concerts, and it could be an hour and a half of memorized music. For some reason in the West, they torture you by, if you're a solo musician, by making you play by memory. That's part of the sort of virtuoso show-off tradition. Let's see if you can do it without any music in front of them. It's like working without a net, you know, like the audience kind of, there's certain bloodlust there. I hope, what if he makes a mistake? I wonder what'll happen then, you know, if he can get out of that. There's a certain amount of violence in a classical music concert. But it's a very strange, tricky business. Your mind plays tricks on you. You're practicing to the last moment. You're sitting in the backstage. These are complex Bach fugues and so forth. And you're kind of going over them, you know, one last time, just to, you know, see if you know, make sure you know them. It's too late. It's not the time to be practicing. You either know it or you don't. It's a very peculiar thing when you step out there too. When you sit down, you can't remember any of it. All you can remember is the first two notes. And you think, oh my God, I can't remember this stuff. How can you don't? You're questioning something which is memory, and we do this occasionally in our own life. Like, oh, I hope I remember what his name is. You know, this kind of questioning of this process that you can't manipulate it. It's either there or isn't. Either it'll appear if it's there, and it won't if it's not there. But after the first two notes, then the next note follows, and the next note follows. That's the way memory does. It shuffles the cards to the top of the deck when they're needed. And if memory worked in any other way, you'd fry the circuits, wouldn't it? If everything would come to the surface at the same time, you'd be overloaded. It's interesting that the Buddha commented on this. He was said to be omniscient, to know everything, being the supreme know-it-all. And he said, and there was another man who claimed at the time of the Buddha also to be the supreme know-it-all. Now these two didn't agree on things, so there was a problem there. Like, you both saying you know it all, and then but you don't agree on things. So they asked about the nature of knowing everything, and Buddha says, well, what is the other was the Jain leader Mahavira. What does he say he knows? Does he say he knows everything at the same time? And he said, yeah. He says, well, I don't say that. I know whatever I need to know, whatever I wish to know. But to know everything at the same time is impossible. It would fries the circuits. You don't know everything at the same time. It's not the way the mind works. A claim like that is a misunderstanding of what it means to know. In the same way, you know, it's incredible what you know. The more we know about computers, the more we realize what kind of storage capacity that an ordinary human mind has. The amount of information available in it is just staggering. But it works in a certain way. It doesn't come out all at once. It works in a certain way. It shuffles it to the top. these processes have a way of working. And we have to appreciate the processes, and the process is the focus on process rather than results. You know, just take care of the processes. The mind, when it's time to produce the results, it's taken care of already. But we are unrealistic in that, and you will see a person who suffers and is confused a lot will not grasp that principle very well. They will only want the goal or the result. They won't want to hear about the process, but they just want the thing now. They, you know, this is what we call the delay of gratification. That there is a process. In order to get a new car, there's a process, right? Well, the person who doesn't believe in process just goes and checks the door and gets in and checks the, see if the key there or the wire there, and then they drive off. Process. This is the how they get the car. They're not tuned into this law of process. So of course they end up having bad results from that. They end up in prison. So a nice Ajahn Chah, one of our Thai teachers, had a saying which I repeat from time to time to people, and that is, he says, looking for peace is like looking for a turtle with a mustache. You won't find it. But when you're ready, peace will come looking for you. And this is, he articulates this in his own experience. He spent 20 years wandering around looking for peace. And then he went home to his home village. And the villagers gave him there was a little bit of tangled forest just out there, worthless kind of stuff. So he went out there and sat under his mosquito net, under a tree, which is all you need to do in Thailand. And in the mornings he would go on alms round and get his bowl of sticky rice and a few bananas. And he realized he came to peace. And it wasn't all the 20 years, he could not find it. But the very process of looking for it was part of the process towards the end of it. But he didn't have to go all of these different places. The peace, again and again, he says, you know, the peace was there. It was within me. What was I doing all those years? What I was doing really was just disturbing myself. I found out that my mind is intrinsically peaceful. Is the nature of the mind is tranquil and peaceful, and what we do is continually disturb it. If you stop disturbing it, it will return to its original nature, its essential nature, which is at peace. It is water. It's like water. Water intrinsically is calm, peaceful, mirror smooth. What could be smoother than the surface of water when it isn't disturbed? This is what the nature of water. It's the ancient world calls the element of water. What is the mark of water? It's cohesion. Not rigidity, but cohesion. You stick your finger in water, pull it out, it goes back together. It resumes its shape. Its intrinsic nature is completely still. It's this activity, this wind blowing across, rippling the surfaces, tides, emotions, energies, turmoil in it that is makes it like that. But you don't have to make it calm or make it tranquil or anything like that. Its fundamental nature is that way, and why it does anything else is due to energies disturbing it. So this is again something that Ajahn Chah sort of learned on his own, in his own experience, that it was about learning not to abuse yourself, not to disturb yourself, not to poke yourself with a stick every time you manage to settle down for a little while. This is one of the metaphors that the Buddha gives for agitation. This is the hindrance of agitation. What is it like to be delivered from the hindrance of agitation? It is like being released from a master, like in being a slave to a master. Every time the slave sits down, the master got a new task for him. Up they get. Just get all this done, and then you just sit down, and then they got a new task for you. All the livelong day, you just sit down for a moment, driven on. Of course, this is within our own psyche. We are both the master and the slave. When we seem to be driven mercilessly by a somewhat cruel and insane master, which is no other than ourselves. So the elimination of agitation is just that. We stop doing that to ourselves. And then the very nature of life is a tranquil experience. It's just stopping doing things. It is not, so it is a process of letting go. You hear this again and again, letting go, letting go. It's not getting something new, because the mind is already, and that's its intrinsic nature, is to return to this state of stillness and peace. And the Buddha is saying, that's why he's saying, this is a universal path I'm teaching. It is the universal nature of the mind, if to come back to its primal simplicity. It's just learning what not to do rather than what to do. Otherwise, it would work, like, for instance, meditation would only work for some people, not others, if it was a matter of positive, putting things together, constructing something. This is one of the words, one of the translations, or in Pali as well, for Nibbana, or Nirvana, the unconstructed. It's not the new construction, it's the unconstructed. The reference to the samsara, the world of moving on, the restless, the not, the place where you cannot find rest, is the constructed. Yeah. Sankata, put together, constructed. Asankata, unconstructed. The construction project is over. Finished. So this is what Ajahn Chah calls your real home. And this is a simile. I think we can all relate to that, because we, in some sense, we're always searching for home. You know? And this is a theme of, you know, that great book title, You Can Never Go Home Again. What is that feeling? You can never go home again. You know that experience, that point in your life where you realize, like, home is a kind of a mental condition. And at a certain point in growth, you no longer can be oblivious to the insecurities of things, temporariness of things. There's a certain discomfort. And, That's you can find that in the Christian mythology as well. Adam and Eve are booted out of Eden, and they can't go home again. Eden is home. They're at home. What is it? Before they disturbed themselves. You know, who disturbed them? They disturbed them. They were in a very peaceful condition, enjoying the intrinsic tranquility of the mind, and then they disturbed themselves. Booted themselves out of the garden, and they couldn't go home again. What do we do? At some point, we don't realize the process. We do it out of non-knowing. But whenever it is, we do it, and we feel homeless, unsettled, or ill at ease, and we people search for homes. It is also the name of what the first stage of the spiritual path. We gave them the name, the homeless, anagarika, one who is homeless. This is the beginning of the spiritual path. But the resolution of the spiritual path is to is to feel at home everywhere. If you feel at home anywhere, you're not at home. If you feel at home everywhere, then you're home. It's a sense of ease outside of particular conditions. If you attach your sense of security and ease to a particular place, particular circumstances, it's just a matter of time before you boot it out of that home. It's not home. So that's our search, in a sense, for this place called home. There's an American poet, Robert Frost. Yeah, Robert Frost, I think. Defining home, he said, home is the place where when you got to go there, they got to take you. And that's, in a sense, if you've got a family, that is, in a sense, what you feel. That's if you have a sense of family, that if you got to go there, you know, they really got to take you. And you have people in your life, too. If they had to go there, you'd have to take them. And that is a sense of what we try to, part of the joy, or part of the beauty of family is, in a sense, exactly that. There's kind of a contract there, which is quite deep. But of course, that's only a superficial level of it. It doesn't really answer deeper things. But it's only by the spiritual path that you find your real home. And that home, if you discover it, is exactly that. It's when you got to go there, it's got to take you. And that is to find that space, that spiritual place, where it is home. That is at that you are no longer searching, wandering, ill at ease and anxious. And that cannot be in the midst of changing conditions. That cannot be those places. That is the definition of samsara. Hey, you find a beautiful thing in the New Testament. The foxes have burrows, and the birds have nests, but the Son of Man has no place to rest his head. And this is a definition of nature of being human. Birds don't have that reflective consciousness, not aware of their existential situation. They sit happily on their nest. The fox, when he's in his burrow, do you think he's anxious or worrying about it? Not there. But on this earth, in this samsara, once you attain consciousness, reflective capacity, you don't really have a place that you can rest. So nibbana is that place. Nibbana is the answer to that that problem. And the path, the Eightfold Path, is if you walk on it, on that path, whenever you make a step on the perfect path, you go ahead one step. But it's not just by making a step on any path or the imperfect steps or anything that you necessarily go ahead. When every time you do make a step, every time your speech is perfect, every time your intention is perfect. What is perfect intention? The absence of ill will, the absence of cruelty, the absence or the presence of renunciation, or the absence of grasping. Whenever you have that intention in your mind, intention without those three things, that is perfect intention. And that is a step along the way to ease. So the title of the talk is that I gave a few weeks back was finding an easy quiet. And on a day of mindfulness, that really, I think, what one has to come with that, just not coming there to enter deep samadhi or anything like that, just coming with an attitude of ease, quiet, because if we don't bring ease and quiet, we won't find ease and quiet. And ease is a very good word, easy. The path is easy when you do it right. It's like when you do anything right, it's easy. It's just not so easy doing it right. So I leave those few remarks for your reflection. And I will, if anybody has any questions or comments, reflections, we have a few minutes left to deal with those things. Yes?
You said the mind is like water. What about the previous karma, like, and the thing coming out of that mind?
Yes. Disturbance comes out of disturbance. It never comes out of tranquility. And so what the Buddha, you know, this is an interesting, it's found in the Anguttara Nikaya, a saying, one of the sayings by the Buddha, and it just flashes by. It's a very little one, but people who have gone on the path have kind of picked this one up and treasured it. Is that, and this is from the Buddha himself, is that the mind is intrinsically light, free, but is disturbed by the transient defilements. It's same with water. Water is not mud. There isn't really muddy water. There's mud and there's water. Right? The mud is swirling around the water. It's not the water. The water is a chemical, you know, formula. It's H2O. I didn't do well at chemistry. H2O. It's not mud and H2O. It's H2O. So the mud is swirling around amidst the H2O. The H2O is not troubled by this. And this is the same with anger or greed or anything. This is not the intrinsic nature of the mind. That is the defilement. That's not the mind. Don't confuse that with you. Don't confuse that with your nature. Don't confuse that with the mind. That is something that is dumped into the mind. So by the way, what should you do about muddy water? How do you get muddy water clear? Yeah. You let it stand. You quit stirring it up. And then what? I mean, it's the intrinsic nature of mud to sink to the bottom. You know, but if you keep wondering if it's clear yet, you know, poke. Every time you poke it, it stirs the mud up. So one of the solutions, mud is confusion. Mud is the simile for confusion. You know, there are five hindrances, and the simile for each of the hindrances is to do with a bowl of water. And this is no accident. The mind is compared to a bowl of water, or water. And in anger is when the water is boiling. Now the Buddha says, a person looks into this bowl of water to see the reflection of their face. And when the water is boiling, then they cannot see the true reflection of their face. It's completely distorted by the bubbles. And then they look into the bowl of water and there's dyes on the surface, yellow, blue, red, dyes swirling on the surface, and they cannot see a clear and accurate representation of their face. Then there is ripples on the surface. The wind is blowing across it, rippling the surface. They cannot see a true reflection. Then there is slime and moss growing on stagnant water. Cannot see a true reflection. And last, there's mud in the water. Cannot see a true reflection. Cannot see clearly to the bottom. These are the five similes for the hindrances in the mind. So the first one is anger. That is heat. And you can feel that anger is heat. And this distorts both the clarity of the water and the possibility of reflection. So not able to see your true reflection of your face, is you're not able to see yourself truly. And not able to see to the bottom of the bowl is not able to see to the bottom of reality. It's to see the clear, transparent nature of reality. The dyes on the surface is a desire. That is a sensual desire. Beautiful, swirling colors. But you're lost in the swirling colors. You can't see an accurate reflection of who you are, and you can't see to the bottom of this. The ripples on the surface is agitation. So the energy, as the mind is rippled by this wind of agitation, so that it distorts your capacity to see yourself and the capacity to see things as they are. Slime growing on the surface is sloth and torpor. It's a lack of oxygenation in the water. A lack of energy, movement, oxygenation in the water. Therefore, slime grows on the surface. And then finally, mud. Now that's the spot. Probably yourself, and you cannot see to the bottom of this. Probably yourself, and you cannot see to the bottom of this mystery, this bowl. And the solutions to all these things are the water returns to its nature. What is going on? Do you have to unheat the water or just turn off the heat? For boiling water, you just don't. Just turn off the heat. It will return to perfect serenity. So this the rippling on the surface of the water, stop blowing on it. Stop creating the wind. For the dyes on the surface, quit dumping the dyes in there. Who do you think put the dyes, the swirling colors in there? You do. It is your focus on, you are picking up the sign of the beautiful. You're focusing exclusively on the sign of the desire, the want, the beautiful in an object. Yeah. Unwisely, that is the nature of lust, greed. Unwise attention to the sign or characteristic of the beautiful. Unwise, not wise. Anger is unwise attention to the sign of the repulsive. Agitation is just undirected, unfocused energies, which tend to just create ripples all over the surface. The sloth and torpor is unwise direction of energies. You've let it go. You're not producing enough energy. And then finally the mud is, you've got to have, first of all, you've got to, don't act on your confusion. Let it, when in doubt, but do nothing. It's good to just let it settle for a little while. When lots of energy, lots of ripples on the surface, what then? Should you act? No, zeal without wisdom is like running in the dark. What happens when you run in the dark? You run right into the branch. You run right into the tree. Yeah. Lots of energy there, but this balances. So that this is the nature of your own common sense reflection. Ask yourself, what's going on here? Am I out of energy? It's a good time to act. Is it a good time? So what should I do? Increase my energy. Got lots of agitation. Maybe I should turn down the wind here. While all confused, let me just let this settle for a little bit. Maybe a good time to produce some calm and clarity. One way to do that is, Buddha says, you got to know where the water hole is. You're like a cowboy. One of the skills of a cowboy. You know, we're from Kamloops now, and there's cows all over the place, and cowboys too. This is not such a great metaphor for Ontario. They'd relate to this in Kamloops, but of course, lots of cows at times. It's a skill being a cow herd, and you're taking cows around. You got to know where the water holes are. And that, this is a simile the Buddha uses for when you have doubt, when you have thirst, you have to know where the water holes are. And what does he mean? He says the water holes are senior monks of learning and experience, or lay people who are wise to consult with. And so there's two things, you know, when you have doubt. One is you require more information, good information. And the other thing is, sometimes you just have to wait. Doubts don't always clear up instantly. And that is, well, you learn that in life. Just you learn that solutions have come, and it's just not the time yet. I just have to wait and just be patient. These are a few things. I mean, these are reflections that you can use for yourself in your own practice. Apply this, be your own teacher, evaluate. These are not outside of common sense. These are saying, like, okay, what's my condition? What's the antidote to this? Yeah. Well, I always have an answer for that. I say, I play the guitar with no strings attached. It's just a different kind of guitar, you know. One of the reasons is that music is a beautiful thing, relatively speaking, in the world. But there are even more beautiful things. I didn't give it up in order to see if I could stand living without it, you know, like as an austerity practice or anything like that. I thought meditation is even a more profound or more beautiful art, and it is interfered with by music. Music, however beautiful it is, the arts which come through the eye, the ear, the nose, the tongue, and the body, and even the arts of ideas through the mind, are coarser arts. They're called the fine arts, but that's only relative to the world. They are actually not the fine arts. They're finer than wrestling, you know, TV wrestling, fairly, or also bar brawls. They're finer than that, definitely, but they're not fine compared to meditation. Meditation is a much finer art than those. And those, if you do those, you will find the residue of that experience is coarser and stickier and syrupier than meditation itself, which is a much lighter, higher clarity. So if you do this and you start to taste kind of spring air, the hot air of the city and the humidity and everything becomes, you start to notice it as heavier and hotter and more humid. So this is it's just a natural. You never give up a good thing for a worse thing. But you automatically let go of a coarser thing for a more refined thing. And those are all those are nice similes. Distillation is the process of reflection. So there's a number of ways to get rid of mud. One is to not, one definitely is, if there's no filtering process going on, if there's no evaporation process going on, then stirring it up won't help much, will it? That's not going to help. That can be a way of stirring things up, yeah. it's not just a given that all the psychological techniques of the schools, the idea of repetition of disturbing events, etc., are necessarily going to produce the desired result. It is a pretty sophisticated machine you're dealing with here, the mind. And if it's not done properly in the full context of it, it may not. If you see, when you stir up, this is a problem, it's karma. Whenever you create an intention, a disturbing emotion, like, say you relive a past trauma, you know, so this is a psychotherapeutic sort of approach. You go over the thing again and again until it ceases to have its kind of fascination and power. You know, in a sense you're going and facing it, you know, again and again, disturbing, playing this stuff through the mind again and again. Well, it's one way, but one of the problems is that whenever you generate anger, it's not just for that time and then it goes away. From the Buddhist perspective, every time you generate an unwholesome emotion, like anger, rage, loneliness, fear, all these things, they have a repercussion, which is called vipaka, or resultant. So the Buddha never encourages that. He says, do not create unwholesome mental states. Your job is to eliminate unwholesome mental states and prevent the arising of unwholesome mental states, and to, if you have any wholesome mental states, to maintain those, and if there's some that you don't have, then to cultivate those. So he's very careful about he's very careful actually to advocate the non-arousing of anger. And he says, now if you have an enemy, and this would be you, if you're being traumatized and you have fear and anger around this as a result of a person or an event or something like that, he says, you know, you have five approaches. First is practice loving kindness. If you're not a saint, you probably can't do that. Well, and practice compassion for that person and for yourself. Can't do that. Practice equanimity, sense of balance, being undisturbed in the midst of this little bit of log rolling. Try to learn to balance yourself. If you can't do that, now those are all wholesome emotions, then don't bring that person to mind. It says, bring it to mind again and again with negative emotion attached to it until you exhaust it. It says, don't bring it to mind. Do not bring it to mind until such time as you can bring it to mind without unwholesome emotion. So what you can do is, if you have these traumatic situations, you don't have to bring this up on a recurrent, you know, by talking through it again and again 1,000 times. Because now just look at other things that you used to have a problem with and you don't have a problem with. And you may not have gotten over this by repetition. You got over it because you became wiser, more loving, larger, a stronger person. And now that information, when it's brought up, does not disturb you. You know how many traumas you've had in samsara? You know, from modern psychology, it's you're dealing with this life only. You know, and think bad things that happen. Sometimes you don't remember them, bring them up, etc. Buried memories, etc. But the Buddha is saying, if you want to search through all of the traumatic things you had, it's not fathomable. It's not just this life. You got all kinds of things that go way, way back. And those are repressed, and for a good reason. It's one of the defense mechanisms of the mind. And it's a defense mechanism for a good reason. Mind is not... mind would be unhinged by traumatic material it's not ready to handle. But the mind allows material to escape into consciousness, usually when it feels that it would not totally, in a dangerous way, you know, completely dangerous way, unhinge it. Before that, it's some like a defense, you know, biological defense mechanism. It doesn't allow the stuff to be admitted to consciousness if it's if one it would unhinge the mind. So there are filters. Now, these filters don't always work perfectly. People are unhinged by experiences, but so he says it's not that profitable. But one of the characteristics of a person who really has no fears anymore is that they can look into all of the regions of the universe. One of the great the disciples of the Buddha, Moggallana, is one of the first to give a tour of heaven and hell. The Buddha said, you know, he's praising Moggallana's psychic power. He's able to look into hell without being disturbed. Why can't we do these things? We cannot take the sights. If I said, you know, see that door there? Just open it, and you'll look. You'll see what hell is like, and that door over there is heaven. You know, I think maybe we would just not. I think we'd look into heaven. That would be very nice. But I don't think I just, you know, would think maybe this is really a little bit. I'm not sure I could handle it. Why would I want to do that to myself? And you're right. The intuitive fear of looking at things that are you're not sure you can handle is a right fear, is a correct fear. When you become strong enough and able enough, you will have a sense that you are able to do these things. If you don't think you can, you probably can't. If you're not sure, that's probably an accurate assessment. It's a doubtful matter. You can, of course, if you have a wise person, they can say, yes, yeah, you can handle this, you know, without falling into negativity. Go ahead. Right. These are some of the exercises for monks. Sometimes they're going off to look at corpses in the middle of the night and decomposing corpses in the middle of jungles but if your teacher's wise, he won't send you off before if you're liable to come back with white hair and have to be locked up in an asylum for the rest of your life. It's not a wise kind of exercise for you. But he feels that you can, it's within your capacity to profit from this exercise, and he might send you off to do it. You might have some resistance. I was certainly in a monastery where, in Thailand, where we did this. And generally speaking, it seemed to be more difficult for the Thais than for the Westerners. One of the reasons is the Thais are completely convinced that there's ghosts everywhere. And so they're not really worried about, it's not the horror of a decomposing body in the middle of the forest at night that stinks to unbelievable, and maggots and everything, and alone, and sleep, you know, and no sleep, and just sitting there. They're worried about ghosts because they're very dangerous. We're worried about germs. This is interesting. Both invisible realms. You know? And the Thais aren't worried about what germs. What do you mean germs? You guys, you know, you got this kind of, something's wrong with you guys. Look, I had a cut the other day. I didn't get infected. And you're worried about ghosts. Eh? I was in that cutia. No ghosts bother me. You know, in just a matter of time. It didn't get you this time. You didn't get infected that time, but next time it could. You know, this is an invisible realm of their germs are everywhere. They're all over the place, and you got to protect yourself against them. Special medicine, special prescriptions, special rites and rituals. Washing the hands, keep the ghost germs away. We have this. We have invisible realms that we are each. You know, is a problem for us.
Yeah. You mentioned about the importance of the process rather than the outcome. Yeah. Could we apply the same thing for attachment? Because you do things without strings attached or detached, and that again you mean for the outcome, like not to be a slave to the outcome, but rather
right.
Involve the process, you can have all the strings attached.
Yeah. You know, there was a guy who was an architect or a designer came to me and we're talking about this, and I said, you know, there's nothing wrong with planning. Sometimes you get the impression that that we're talking about don't plan anything, just walk out into there and let karma happen to you and so forth. It just kind of sounds very mystical. But the Buddha was a great planner. He planned lots of stuff. But the difference is that you understand that the design for a house is not a house. It's not a future house either. It's a piece of paper with a drawing on it. As long as you understand that, there's no problem. You can draw, as long as you, this is a drawing, here it is right now in front of me. If that's all it is, and that is all it is, then it's not a problem. But if it is a kind of ulcer-producing vision which must be brought into existence, because your whole identity is around this and your job and everything, that is a false notion of the future existing and all these things. So as far as the goal is, you know, the goal is just a picture on a paper, and then you draw the picture and then forget the picture and do the process, get the 2x4, put that 2x4 on the other 2x4, nail them together, then do the with the next one. That is the process, and that in itself is it's a very simple process. One board at a time, one nail at a time. No problem. And then, do you have to concern yourself with the result at all? If you don't put the 2x4s into place, will the house appear? No. If you put the 2x4s in the place, will the house appear? It must. It must. Because a house is just our name for a bunch of 2x4s. You know, there isn't a house there, but there's a bunch of 2x4s there. Same with meditation, like calm and peace, is just our name for having put the preconditions in place. All that's really there is just the preconditions. Lately I've been talking about this quality called adhitana, or determination and resolution. And I'll be giving another talk about the whole matter, but it's good to make determinations. This is one of your things that you have to build in your character if you want to come to perfect this. And in fact, you must be perfect. Before you're out of samsara, you've got to perfect the capacity to make a determination. Carry it through. Make a resolution and carry it through. How do you do that? Again, you don't just wish for it to happen. You do it by doing it. So you start exercising resolutions. Now, you divide them into three. A resolution which you're quite certain you can do. A resolution which you're figure 50-50. And then a resolution which is 90-10. You know, 10% possibility, 90% failure. People are afraid of they think, well, I better not decide to do that because I might not be able to make it, and that wouldn't be good for me. I should only decide to do things that I can do. I'm certain I can do. No, you should do three things. Ones that you're certain you can do, ones that you're 50-50, and then ones you're uncertain. And this is an exercise in self-knowledge. What do you know which ones that you can do? Do you know which ones are unlikely, and do you know which ones are 50-50? This is good because this develops your sense of panya, your wisdom in knowing yourself, and then to undertake them. And it's all right to fail at a 90-10 kind of thing. You actually accumulate or develop the perfection of determination by undertaking those things. You become stronger. But you have to know what category that's in, and then it's not a matter of just flinging yourself in a deluded way. It's trying something that is beyond your capacity, or very, very likely beyond your capacity. That strengthens your capacity to make a resolution and continue it. So, you know, if you want to train for a marathon, one way is, you know, just go out and run a marathon. But if you're wise, you'll realize it's 99% sure that you won't be able to make it, but you'll make it the first mile. The first mile will have benefit for you. Then you can also do things like, in order to learn to run a marathon, you can start with a mile. And you're sure you can run a mile. Then you can also try 10 miles. you're 50-50, maybe. But you just have to know, okay, I can run a mile. If things are going well, I could make 10 miles. And I'm absolutely sure, almost 90% sure, that I could never run 25 or 26 miles. But the beginning of this thing is all, they're all beneficial in terms of cultivating effort and determination and resolution. And in other words, it's not unrealistic to undertake things that you probably can't achieve. But it should be accompanied by the realization that it's probably not achievable. So to do things that weigh beyond your capacity and then be disappointed is a lack of wisdom. It's not a lack of resolution, it's a lack of wisdom. And the history is full of expeditions, you know, that where these people didn't understand their capacity and they brought a whole bunch of other people along with them, and just disasters. And then there are other expeditions where it was, you know, a reasonable chance. So this is something you can do in your life, and you should do it on a regular basis. You know, determined to say to eat your whole meal without fantasizing. That's an interesting. You have all kinds of opportunities in life to do this. See if you can, you know, one of the things that goes along with eating is fantasy. You notice that? You try to pay attention during your whole meal to what you're doing. The chewing, the taste, just be there for the meal. It's the pleasure of eating triggers fantasy and proliferation. So, you know, you can make a little determination. Okay, I'm sure I can make it through the pie. I'm not sure if I can make it through the mashed potatoes without my mind wandering. So, the things, all kinds of little determinations. The exercise of there's a lot of spiritual exercise one can undertake. Well, I think we'll close that off for today. And we'll do our